Okay, I think we'll get started. Welcome to the Brookings Doha Center, first of all. Thank you all for coming. My name is Shadi Kamit. I'm the Director of Research here at the Brookings Doha Center. I'm very excited to have these two great speakers with us who will shed light on an issue that I think many of you are following. It's going to be a big week at the UN, so that's why we're all here. Ever since the Arab Spring began, it's gotten harder and harder to predict events, and what seemed impossible one day becomes possible the next. And I think going into this very important week, it's really hard to know what is going to go on. There's a whole variety of scenarios that could take place depending on how different countries react to an unprecedented situation. There's a lot of variables here. We have the U.S., we have Israel, we have the UN General Assembly, we have the Palestinians, of course. So, and there's still some doubt about what each player is going to do. And I think what's also interesting here is that it's not just about the Palestinians and Israelis anymore, while the rest of the Arab world watches in silence. What we're seeing now, because of the Arab Spring, is an Arab world that is empowered, and they want to have something to say about the Arab-Israeli conflict. And as countries become more democratic, as in Egypt, for example, Egypt is going to play a more assertive role, and it already is, as we've seen in the last couple months. So, with that in mind, I think we'll get to it. Our first speaker, Mahjoub Zoueri, will talk about the regional context and the intra-Palestinian issues. And then Salman Sheikh, our second speaker, will talk about the UN, the U.S., and the scenarios going forward in the coming weeks and months. So let me just go ahead and introduce the two speakers. Mahjoub Zoueri is the head of the Humanities Department at Qatar University and a professor of contemporary history of the Middle East. He is also a visiting professor at Durham University. Salman Sheikh, as many of you know, is our director here at the Brookings Doha Center and a fellow at the Brookings Institution. He worked with the United Nations for nearly a decade, primarily on Middle East policy, as the special assistant for the UN Special Coordinator for the Middle East Peace Process, and as political advisor to the UN Secretary General's personal representative for Lebanon during the very important 2006 war. So, Salman not only writes and does research on the issue, but he's been on the ground and knows the practical impact of what's going on here, knows many of the important players firsthand, so he'll draw on his experience in that respect. So, with that, Mahjoub, would you like to start?
Thank you, Shadi, and thank you for the invitation. Good afternoon, good evening now. It's my pleasure to be again here in Brooklyn, Doha, Brooklyn, and speak about an issue where basically it's now, it's very difficult to speak, to hide the Arab Spring, Arab Revolution, but in the top of these important issues now in the world. I will share with you some of the points I feel that we need to remember when we look at what's going to happen on Friday in the United Nations, if it happens. The first point is Palestinians and the Palestinian cause was always forgotten from the international community. That's our part. Because of that kind of denied a Palestinian issue, he declared the Palestinian state in 1988 in Algeria. So basically, Palestinians used to this initiative. They want to remind the world, look, we have an issue. We are people living under occupation. We are the last limitation of living under occupation. So basically, they have this kind of justification to go to the United Nations and speak about the state. In the last few years, we witnessed the failure of so-called negotiation. And this, this kind of failure can be explained in different ways for different reasons. The nature of the Israeli government, the situation within the Palestinian Sea, Gaza and West Bank, Hamas and Fatah, I think on the top of that, the failure of the American foreign policy in the last 2 years to deliver on that issue of Palestinian problem. I think think the situation inside the United States and the economic crisis had led to see the administration focus on the matter that was more important to them, was more appealing, or they may bring back Barack Obama as president in 2 years. So basically, you know, these three reasons actually can be seen, can explain to us the issue of timing. Why is he thinking of this now? Last September, Obama was speaking about an Palestinian state in September 2011. So basically, it was kind of a rumor or a lot of debate around it even before what Abbas was trying to do on Friday. The issue of Palestinian state was always mentioned, at least since 1988. It was on the top of the debate. And all of what's happening since 1993, Madrid conference is actually to lead to see an independent Palestinian state with Jerusalem capital for this state. So why now terms are absent or not happening with this? The other issue is, I think we need to take into consideration what I call it the changing mood, regional mood. We have the absence of Mubarak, the issue of Arab Spring, weakening statements, the changing of alliance in the region, Turkish war. These are, if you put them together and look at them, you find that there is those led, whether we like it or not, to change the mood, the political mood. I think those led to see, I think for the first time maybe, to see Arab states decide to go within the context of Arab League to go to the United Nations. Because this, Abbas going to the United Nations with the support of Arab states. So basically, this is a unique case, actually, because of the change in mood in the region. And I think here, this is the power of people. I think Arab Spring, whether those who are with or against, Arab Spring has delivered a very important text, message, which basically, look, you have a very important impact on your mind, which is your public opinion, your people. If you rely on them, if you take them into consideration, they can support you. Even if they're not in a good shape now, but at least take them into consideration when you shape your policies. And I think one issue also is important is we are witnessing a new discourse about Israel in the region start with Turkey. In the last 60 years, there was kind of denial of Israel is not a legitimate state, and then we moved on to the case of Iran is not a legitimate state, Arab changed their mind, accepted Israel. Turkey, from the beginning, accepted Israel as a state in the region, and now its discourse it is main message. Look, you are a state as Israel, but you should accept the fact for the international law. And this is a message which I will try to say more than once. You cannot act without respecting the international law. This message changed the mood in the region. But look, we don't reject you as a state, but you should accept and respect the international law and behave as that. You cannot take law in hand and do whatever you want. And this message actually put Israel in a situation in the corner that, you know, you always say, you know, people, they don't want, they reject me, they refuse me, they don't want to accept me. This is the state, accepted you, but you have a real issue with it because you don't want to accept the matter. I think this changed the nature of political dynamic in the region. If we go to a little bit to the Palestinian scene, Abbas is going to the United Nations as chairman of PLO. And I think this kind of important issue, because basically, with a lot of debate about his legitimacy as Palestinian president, he relied on the fact that PLO was the main negotiation on the issue of Palestine since 1993. And also, so basically, he goes with that support of being the chairman of PLO. I think by that, it has advantage and it has disadvantage. Advantage that no one can, raise doubts about the movement. On the other hand, those like Hamas and other Palestinian organizations, they only criticize them for doing such thing. In last 5 years, there was no real achievement in the Palestinian Sea. It was from failure to failure. the reconciliation has failed, that the situation has gotten worse, from bad to worse, the political situation, the economic situation, there is no real support from the national community, real division has been seen. So basically, the symbolic of this message that Mr. Abbas wants to do is actually to the president himself. Look, we have something to do, at least we want to do something. This may change or break the silence about this language. Because we need to be silent about this. This may break the silence, and this may lead to change within the Palestinian Israeli politics. We may want this kind of change within the government. We may change in Israel. This may convince the American administration that, look, you forget the issue for 2 years now. You have to go back and put it in a particular reality, which it has failed. All what you have been done for is a failure. So basically, they may think of things suggesting the issue and put it in the top reality. Last point, the new regional rules will lead to the change in the region. If they want to stay in the state, when they deny that, they will be the region. Because this change started in September 2010 is moving. And no one can stop it. And I'm not saying it will lead to paradise, but it will lead to real change in the region. If others want to pick them on and try to invest in that, it's the time. It's not going to be the reason. Thank you so much.
Good evening, and it's wonderful to see you all here. Yes, let me speak a little bit about what Daddy said and also draw a little bit on what the group was saying. I started actually painting two images for you, which I've sort of seen in cartoons, and Daddy explained to me. One is the idea of diplomats going wild at the UN. There's actually a riot going on at the United Nations right now. People scurrying between walls, bits of paper being moved around, lots of close conversations, lots of finger pointing, lots of telephone calls. And papers do matter in this case. So something that I'll come back to in a second. The other image is actually was in an Israeli newspaper today in Ma'ariv. It's the image of Abu Mazen, President Abbas, standing on top of the United Nations building with two wings, which are the Palestinian flag, kneeling, getting ready to jump. And underneath him, there are diplomats in suits, some saying jump, others saying don't do it. So at least, we can tell you the Israelis have lost their sense of humor in this very important period for the Middle East. Let me say, in terms of the Arab Spring, that has been what has been a changing dynamic, as Majroof explained and Shadi pointed to. I think what's now going on, and by the way, it's always been said to me that at the end of the day, though, we come back to the Arab-Israeli conflict, and we're now here. And in my view, the Arab Spring combined with the events that we are going through in New York is a game changer. The Arab-Israeli dispute is very much now center stage on the world stage. We don't, of course, have to be here. We don't have to be in this particular predicament. If we had negotiations started, certainly on the Palestinian side, you had a dream ticket of President Abbas and Salam Fayyad preparing and building the state, ready for state. Unfortunately, we didn't have the parameters for negotiations over the last couple of years. We know if we had parameters which were focused on negotiating around 1967 borders with land swaps, discussion on Jerusalem, an equitable solution on the refugee issue, and a multilateral process perhaps to support it, we wouldn't be here. We would have had negotiations which would have maybe made much more headway than they had. Instead, we've had more settlement building and a breakdown of trust between the parties. In fact, settlements in the 18 years since Oslo have more than tripled. both in the West Bank and also in Jerusalem, even if there has been, of course, the unilateral withdrawal of Israel from the Gaza Strip. So, where are we? I think the Palestinians are actually attempting a brand new paradigm of internationalizing this particular dispute, because those negotiations involving a very select number of actors led by the United States has not worked, and I'm afraid the trust has broken down in that respect. And this approach of the world being flat, where Palestinians and Israelis can be together in a room and come to a solution, has not seemed to have worked. In fact, the negotiations that were finally put together only lasted about 6 weeks, in sort of September to about October last year. So the Palestinians are trying to make this an international responsibility. And this 61 years, nearly 61 years since the partition plan was first presented by the United Nations, the responsibility is going back again to the halls of the United Nations. And yet, I don't think we should be under any illusion. The focus is still very much on a two-state solution. Something that the Palestinians have said, something that the Israeli Prime Minister said he's committed to, as well as others in the international community. The question now is, how do we get there? And some of the scenarios that are playing out in New York, in my view, are trying to create the conditions, perhaps a more level playing field, for the kinds of negotiations to try and achieve that two-state solution, where previously it has not worked. I should also recall, of course, that the Palestinians have already been told that they're kind of ready for statehood. The Quartet actually did it in March 2010. The World Bank and the donor groups have been doing it over the last couple of years, but we haven't got that two-state solution. So now we're up. We've got our part bargaining going on at the UN. Every day there is a different scenario. I guess round one, the bell for that was sounded last Friday, when President Abbas said that he was going to the Security Council. And round two, the bell for that will be sounded this coming Friday, when President Abbas is going to hand over his letter of application to the UN Secretary General. So we are going to the Security Council. Unless something dramatically changes, we're going to the Security Council. So what is the scenario there right now? Just to give you, I guess, a little flavor of what's going on. Well, the first scenario is, can the Palestinians get the 9 affirmative yes votes that you need to pass any resolution at the United Nations? If the Palestinians are not able to achieve that, then the US don't have to veto. If they've got more than that, then the United States will face a tricky choice, whether we go to a vote and whether we force a vote at that time, and then whether the United States and others, permanent members of the Security Council, actually exercise their veto. Right now, as it stands, and it's like a football table of scores, it seems as if the countries that we're focusing particularly on are Bosnia and Herzegovina and Nigeria. There's also some discussion about Nigeria's voting intentions, also in terms of Portugal, etc., etc. There are 10 non-members of the Security Council who, I bet you, are getting a lot of conversations and a lot of pressure put on them. In order to vote. And of course, the US is in a full court press to try and achieve at least the 7 votes which are either a no or abstentions in order not to allow the Palestinians to get to those 9 votes. But what I would also say to you is that, 9 votes, what I would also say to you though is that there is a scenario whereby which the Palestinians may well bag those votes, but we don't necessarily move straight to a vote. There's also a scenario where the President of the Security Council, which is normally the case, will refer this to a special committee inside the Security Council, which consists of all the members of the Security Council, to discuss this particular application. It's called the Committee on New Admissions. Article Rule 59 of the Security Council Rules and Procedures. So have a look at it. It's worth reading up on right now. This committee could take a number of months before we actually get to any kind of a vote. And in fact, it may go backwards and forwards in that respect. I'll remind you, even Israel's application, which of course Israel's formal declaration did come through the United Nations, was first, given in November 48, and it didn't come 47, and it wasn't admitted as a member until March the following year, 5-6 months. Now, a 5-6 months delay in this particular environment would be very interesting indeed, given everything else that's going on in the region, and given the tumult that the region is already in. One way to avert that, of course, is to have a timeout, whereby which actually there's an agreed timeout between all parties in order to get negotiations started. But if there is a breakdown of the diplomatic talks, then that, I think, will have a profound impact in terms of raising the diplomatic pressure at the UN, but also on the ground. And not just in Palestine, as we've already seen with earlier events in Cairo and Jordan, amongst other places. Then what is the scenario in the General Assembly? It may be that the Palestinians also choose to go to the General Assembly. The conventional wisdom, of course, is that they may well do that, but if they do, they will be applying for an upgrading of their status from a non-member entity to a non-member state, with observer states, rather like the Vatican. But that is a scenario which, right now, the Americans and Israel and some of its allies, even if they're in a minority, are trying to make sure it doesn't happen, because that does mean that the Palestinians, for now, would have the voting rights, would have the right to take Israel, for example, to the International Criminal Court or to the International Court of Justice and other things, and to pursue illegal activities of Israeli individuals or even groups through that recourse, something that they've not had before. The Europeans, right now, from what I understand, are trying to invent a new category, which is that the Palestinians get non-member status, but they don't have that
right, as a way of trying to build some sort of a confidence. Anyway, you get my drift. There are scenarios. There's one more scenario I'll point you to, which is 1950 Resolution 373 was passed by the General Assembly, actually initiated by the United States at the time in the lead-up to the Korean tensions in the midst of the Cold War, whereby which the General Assembly could actually override a Security Council veto. And that can happen if half of the membership of the United Nations actually agree to what is called an emergency special session, and then two-thirds actually vote for that resolution. It has happened before. In fact, out of the 10 said special sessions, 6 have focused on the Middle East. Now, that would be tantamount, if we do go down that route, I think, to the Palestinians pressing the nuclear option, because then we would really get into a no-hold-barred kind of race to try and secure the two-thirds votes that you would be needed to pass that resolution. And let me just remind you, in the UN Charter, actually the General Assembly is the organ that has primary responsibility, and the Security Council has secondary responsibility, and it is because of Resolution 373 under this Uniting for Peace resolution that you can have this kind of recourse. But I don't think we're anywhere close to that yet. So those are the scenarios. And let me just quickly say just a couple of observations on top of that. Out of all of this, who's going to emerge the winner and the loser? Nobody knows. I don't think the Palestinians know, the Israelis know, the Americans know. We're still a number of days away even from round two starting. This is a very long time. And in fact, as Secretary Hillary Clinton said yesterday, we're in the early days, and I think she's actually absolutely right in that respect. It may be that, of course, Israel does come out the loser. It will come out more isolated than ever. Its borders look more porous or more vulnerable than ever. It may be, you know, that we're back to 1967, that we have Israel feeling that it has to do something in order to safeguard its security. The Europeans may well come out the losers, or they may well come out divided. In fact, I like to say that there are probably some who are for a Palestinian vote, for Palestinian membership. There are those against, and there'll be those who will just have to flip a coin in the last few minutes in order to be able to arrive at something. There's the Arabs themselves. Now, as a bloc, they have indicated that they're going to support strongly the Palestinian membership. But we've heard that before. And when push comes to shove, it will be very interesting to see whether that is the case and whether they use the leverage with others too in order to try and ensure that. And then finally, of course, there's the United States. And let me just dwell on that for 1 minute. The United States, if it does veto, I think will emerge as probably one of the biggest losers out of this episode. It will also probably emerge as one of the biggest losers in the Arab awakenings which are taking place. And countries which have not necessarily gone as far as the United States in supporting people's aspirations in places like Libya and Syria, elsewhere, would actually come out rather well, especially if they vote for Palestinian membership, countries like Russia and China. The next few days will tell us how the United States is able to manage this particular process. It's not had a good start in terms of we're not at the negotiations which have really borne fruit. Instead, now we're looking at a supreme will, a supreme look in American ability to be able to affect the situation. And if they don't, for example, achieve the 9 votes in order and do have to veto, I think it will signify that perhaps their influence is very much in decline in this region, and that they're not able to be the one actor that can steer this particular process. It will certainly be a sign of understanding of U.S. influence in the region. And with that,
thank you so much. Before we open up to questions, I just want to get the ball rolling and use my position as chair with questions to both of our speakers. You're both talking about how the paradigm is still a two-state solution, but if you kind of take a broader perspective and look a decade or two down the road, what I'm having trouble understanding is the Israelis are willing to offer less. They have a more right-wing government. The movement in Israel has veered to the right. There isn't really a strong constituency for peace as there was in the late 1990s. So that's Israel right there. The Palestinians, the wind is blowing in their direction, so there's going to be less of an incentive for them to compromise the way they were doing 10 years ago. All the trend lines are moving in their direction. The Arab world is coming behind them. And we see that in the Erdogan, as I mentioned, in Egypt. So, and the Palestinians, I think, have a sense that history is on their side. So considering that, where do the two sides really meet? I mean, maybe just kind of, if either or both of you could kind of give us what the longer-term scenario could be and what would an actual solution look like in practice.
It's a very good point. Of course, we are still talking about the two-state solution. I'm saying there's a changing paradigm in terms of the internationalization and in terms of the negotiations. But yes, the goal is still very much the two-state solution. This is a very important point because this may be one of the last times that the international community and the process can really get behind this, particularly because you have Palestinian leadership. Despite all the challenges that it faces, that is already stuck. What is interesting, even in the changing dynamics in the region, is that you had Prime Minister Erdogan of the Arab League, you had others, and you of course got the Arab Peace Initiative on the table since 2002, which is still strongly supporting the two-state solution. The reality on the ground, of course, is that we're moving further away from it because of the continued settlement building and the actual sort of facts on the ground are making that much more difficult. This may be, of course, the last chance to do it, which is why, of course, we need a multilateral effort, perhaps with the US at its lead, which enshrines this particular paradigm and this solution, and which is a piece of paper strong enough in order to be able to change the facts that have emerged on the ground? If you ask Palestinians, what's calling my scene is that they're still broadly in favour of a two-state solution. If you ask the Israelis, the polls that I've seen also say the same thing. We just haven't been able to find a way in order to realise that. And let me say, the current effort is probably one of the most amateurish I've ever seen in negotiations. And you know, I've been following this for and being involved in it for quite a while. And it's really regrettable that we have got to a stage where we're having a confrontation on voting rather than on trying to collectively find that solution.
Actions. The United States vetoing the application of Palestine, this may be perceived by others as ending the whole issue of statehood. And this would be, I think, what the United States is doing now is trying to not to reach that point, trying to send the message that we still believe in two state solution. However, we believe this can happen through negotiation and engagement. But the experience for the last 5 years, with, as you mentioned, with the government that had approved that there is no real way that any Israeli side could have to achieve such thing. So basically, I think it's a tricky moment to see what the United States will do, especially and how this would affect the whole idea of the resolution. I think the Europeans, Russia, other states, they will be worried about the future of the solution after if they reject this application.
Okay, so we'll open up to your questions. Try to extend possible to keep your questions brief. We'll start with the ambassador here.
Thank you very much. Very much for the idea. I'm both Jew and Osama. I'd like to go to the end of the issue here, but I will comment on the mark for the winners and the losers. Here, for us Palestinians, either we become good winners or slow winners. I don't think much that we are going to be the losers, because we've been losing for more than 60 years. To add another failure to us, it doesn't change much our situation. But sure, we are going to win. If we get the membership, it's a great step forward that we make the peace process brought back to the tag, you know. It's not going to be leading this process at all. Now, once we get the membership, we will become a state, and its land is under the tradition by another member state of the United Nations. So, the whole game of the process of negotiating in order to come to peace and solution will be changed, which is very important. It's a great step. Of course, as Dr. Salman said, we don't expect much that is going to happen now, because the Americans are very determined. To use the veto in case it is it goes to voting, you know. We will be very sorry if we see the Americans vote use the veto against it, because the loser, the greater loser, will be the credibility of the American administration as an honest broker. It will never be neither honest nor a broker in the future. And the other losers will be the Israelis, because you know it will be very clear that the Israelis who are not serious and have never been serious, they will show more clearly that they are not serious, that they want to be a partner in this process. They want to impose their will as triumphants on the Palestinians and the Arabs as the losers in a war, you see. So that puts the international community, as you said, under the responsibility to take care of our affair again, because so far during the 18 years of negotiations, the international community was not allowed to be a partner in the negotiating game, you see. But never the United States was able to make Israel abide by the rules of the game, I mean to play the game of negotiations according to the parameters based on the international legitimacy. And the Palestinians all the time showed readiness to an extent that makes us sometimes appear ridiculous. Readiness to negotiate. And whatever the Americans propose as a way to facilitate negotiations, even if it is not logical, you know. We accept, and all the time the Israelis don't accept. I think the speech of Mr. Obama on the 19th of May, when he talked about the Palestinian state, or then the borders of 1967, when Abraham Lincoln swaps of land, you know, it was accepted by the Palestinians. But who opposed it? Mr. Netanyahu came to the White House, and he gave 7 no's to President Obama, and went to the Congress, and everybody knows the game which was in the Congress for loading all the time. So, here the Israelis are calling the American effort. So, it would be, maybe it would be very sorry if the Americans use the veto against us, but we know that they are going to use, because they told us, please don't go. We don't use the veto. We said, thank you, don't use the veto. We said, no, but you, if you go, we are obliged to do the veto. Commit it. Once again, you know, there is a story about the grandmothers in Palestine, the mother-in-law says to her daughter-in-law about the loaf of bread. A full loaf of bread, please don't break it into pieces. And never eat pieces of the loaf of the bread, and eat until you are satisfied. Now this is the same game the Americans are playing with the Palestinians. So we are not going to be big losers. Either we win a good step forward, or we will a smaller step that is upgrading the status of the Palestinian, as you just said, when we have a non state and we will be members of the ICC, which is very important. It counts for this reason. So here we don't think that that will be. But if the other partners, the Europeans, don't come to help here, they will be using also, different cause. So, in this part, I don't think that we are going to lose too much. But another point here, I want to say that now, on the 23rd, I mean, on next Friday, it's not going to be either yes or no and it's finished. For us, it is the beginning of a long process. It might take more than a year, as you said. Now, in case the Inspector General used that trick of forming a committee to discuss it, and that takes several months. Okay, we've been patient for more than 6 years. We can wait for a couple of months, 4 or 5, 6. But who knows what will happen on the ground? Things are, very critical situation in Palestine. And as we will say, the whole atmosphere around us is changing. And I hope that all the partners here, the United States and Europeans, are aware of the real potential dangers in case the Palestinians feel support. Thank you.
Can I just add, in terms of the losers, there is, of course, a scenario in the day after, whereby which Palestinians lose, in that the Israelis decide that you're not a partner to negotiate with, start withdrawing tax revenues that are Palestinian tax revenues, but which they collect on your behalf, which they did in 2000.
Yeah. We won't get our salaries, that's all.
Yes, which is about 100 million, I think, a month, actually. And then also, of course, there is bills who are being dissuaded right now within Congress being discussed about withdrawing US aid money, which is about half a billion a year. And then, of course, on top of that, the Europeans, who are a part of the concern, have paid something like, I think, last year, $1.4 billion in aid to the Palestinian side. As well as, of course, other diplomatic measures that could be taken against you, those would, I guess, have quite a dramatic effect in terms of the viability of the Palestinian Authority to function. And again, the question would be, will Arabs or others step up in order to close that gap? So often, Arab states have pledged, but they don't necessarily come up with the funds that they should promise. And that has been a pattern that I've certainly seen since the start of the Second Intifada in 2000.
Okay, question here. Can people just identify themselves, their affiliation?
name is Rich, and I'm doing my ambassador of Bosnia and Herzegovina. I'm not comment how Bosnia and Herzegovina will actually vote on Friday. But two-thirds of the votes is positive vote is already here, so we will see. Let's assume that we will have less positive outcome of the Friday meeting. And in your opinion, whether the future negotiation will be in line or under the umbrella of the recent proposals of Tony Blair. We read something about it in the newspapers. Whether the future, in that case, negative scenario, let's say, whether the future negotiation will be in that way. And another thing which really bothers me the last 2-3 days is there a complete unity in your mind within the Palestinians? And the recent comments, at least what we can read in some newspapers of some Hamas dignitaries, questioning the legality of President Abbas' initiative, is it a kind of play of the game, or that the President Abbas has been stopped in the back even before?
I'll take the first week, then maybe you want to take the second week. Future negotiations are the deadlines. I mean, well, the current negotiation structure is not working. And what Tony Blair is suggesting, I think, is only a variation of that. What is clear to everybody, what was being actually suggested when President Obama came into office was start early, which he did, for which he has to be given a lot of credit. The first set of phone calls he made were to President Abbas and others. But also to set the parameters, and that's something that they've not been able to do. And then also to work with those in the international community who've been moving this along. It's on the second and third, I think, where we need to focus on how we can move the negotiations forward. And that means having more active, more of a multilateral process than we've had. And also to set quite clearly the defined parameters which we all know about, our borders, our security, our refugees, and Jerusalem, which need to be discussed. And that is, in 1988, when Yasser Arafat actually declared Palestinian statehood, the American administration then was extremely strong in nipping in the bud any move towards the UN at that time. It showed, I guess, the relative strength of the nation. But they didn't leave it at that, and especially on the back of the first Gulf War, they really initiated the Madrid peace process. And I would actually say that this is the time whereby we're defining parameters and moving forward in a very time-bound discussion involving all the key countries and regional organizations may well put the pressure on parties to come to the kind of solution that we're all hoping for.
I just to something about the issue of Palestinian division. It's not a new. I mean, there was always some kind of division within the Palestinian scene, and this is also you can see in difference even in a Jewish state. Look at Turkey, for example. All of its foreign policy towards the Arab world, and look what the opposition is doing. They go to Damascus and meet the government and speak to them. This kind of division is indeed something normal, but I think the statement we heard from Ismailia and Rawda Shalah and Bahrain, those are the main statements criticizing Ambassador Tony. I think they may be the main criticism for two reasons. One is that the whole issue of reconciliation has not been succeeded, and they basically President Abbas himself. In the case of Ramadan Shalah, they know that it will take a lot of time. And actually, he mentioned in his speech that, you know, it will have to take more time and they will, and others they will gain. So basically, this kind of division is, I see it as a normal, but from outside of we expect that Palestine will go as a one part of the United Nations. It's a real division, and it will go until you have
you have this, you know, this kind of environment where the Palestinian actors, when the analysts stop intervening in the Palestinian scene. Because one of the reasons behind this division is actually the intervention from outside. We can't judge. And until that intervention is you know, there, I'm not sure that we can have this kind of unity within the Palestinian scene.
As far as the issue of the two-state solution has been accepted by all sides, I'm not sure that this is the only problem, actually. I think that the main problem is also how every side perceives the state, the two-state solution, what is their understanding of the Palestinian state, for example. And when it comes to the Israeli understanding of what is, or their vision of the Palestinian state, I don't think that we can call this as something that is within a state definition, because what their perception actually is closer to Bantustan than to a real state with, you know, a viable economic state. This is the first issue. The second, when you talked about the possibilities of punishing the Palestinian Authority by the US and the EU for by cutting funding, I frankly don't think that this is really dramatic. First of all, because this is first of all a material issue. Secondly, because I don't think that the US and the EU push that to the extreme, because I don't think it is in their interest to weaken the Palestinian Authority and to create a kind of vacuum in the region.
Palestinians with half of the airport. Palestinians, yeah, I mean, Palestinian Authority is not serious. They are, I mean, demanding a seat in the UN while they're coordinating the security with Israel, the extended hands to USA for $500,000, and Saddam Fayyad is going to meet Israelian in the UN. America is not serious, but I asked one of Egyptian revolutionaries, say to America, please know that your blind bridges to Israel, you will lose hearts and minds of Egyptians or the area, you will not run, will lose your services. Thank you.
My name is David Barch. I'm a lecturer at Cornell University. So, one of you, I'm sorry, said that with the Arab Spring awakening, that there's a newfound voice of democracy in the region. And certainly that's. It's hard to say that nothing will happen to that. But my question is, are they too. Egypt and Libya and some other countries are so concerned, they have so many domestic issues going on, can they really afford to spend the diplomatic energy to outside their own borders.
That's true. I mean, many people pointed out that, of course, in Tahrir Square they weren't burning Israeli flags. Neither were they doing that in Benghazi or anywhere else. But what is clear is that the passions of this particular issue, the Palestinian issue, and then having parallel a narrative talking about the justice and dignity and rights of Arabs, how it excludes those for Palestinians. So it's something, it's a natural thing that I think many Arabs do, of course, come back to this issue, especially when it is on the center stage. And I think it underscores the need for Israeli leaders to make peace, not just with a few select number of leaders in the Arab world, as has been the case, but also to try and extend that peacemaking effort to the people of the region. I mean, that's become blatantly clear. It also means, of course, that the people in the region have to understand that Israel is here to sit, and its security and its own existential concerns are something which will, if they're not met, which will also drive the conflict. And that is something I think is extremely important for us also to know.
Arab Spring has set a new agenda in what so-called regional order and international order. And this agenda basically, I understand your argument, yeah, people are busy within their own borders, but they are also, they have to change their agenda and to change directions. The issue of the semantic, there is a real change on so-called the security arrangement in the region. In previous, before September 2010, White House called Mubarak, they can solve a lot of problems. Now this, they cannot make this phone call. Because at least they need to convince the people of Cairo to take them not half an hour or 2 hours, 10 days. So basically there is a new security arrangement forced itself and set a new agenda to the external third, and they have different realities. If you go back to pre-September 2010 and look at the briefs to the President of the United States, Foreign Minister, or the Prime Minister of Britain, or President of France, they have different brief barriers. What happened to the issue of foreign terror, what happened to the security, to the peace process, now they have different briefs since September. So this, the whole, what I call changing, would set different agenda, and I think this would lead that they have to respond to that changing of agenda.
If I could just add on Egypt very quickly, we're in election season right now, presidential and parliamentary, and everyone's competing with everyone else to see who can be more pro-Palestinian and anti-Israel. So the military council is in charge now. They're a status quo power, but they won't be in charge forever. And whatever government is elected is going to have to prioritize Palestine because Egyptians are angry about it. And that's what democracy means. You have to be theoretically responsive to the will of the people. So I think we're going to see a shifting dynamic. And the opposition groups in Egypt, they don't like each other at all, but the one thing they agree on is how much they hate Israel. So I think that's sort of where we're at right now on that.
Can I throw this one more? On democracy and the will of the people, I mean, we've also seen that, frankly, in Europe, there has been much more sensitivity and perhaps sympathy for Palestinians still living under occupation. And I have personally witnessed in 2008, time of the Gaza War, how Londoners and other Brits were coming out and demonstrating, and how that did have quite an impact on British government policy. We will see that in France, we will see that in other places, so it's not just confined to the region.
Francesca Spadio from the Peninsula newspaper. Saudi Arabia told the US that if they will use the veto, they will seriously compromise their relations with the Saudis. I wanted to know, in your opinion, how serious is this threat and what is the role of the GCC countries in the dynamics with the Palestinian UN membership? Thank you.
Well, I think time will tell. That's the hedging answer. Certainly we've seen something very, we've had something significant on Monday where Saudi Arabia has given $200 million to the Palestinian Authority in order to plug its proven budget deficit. That's a clear sign of intent, I guess. It will also be interesting to see whether Saudi Arabia is willing, along with the GCC states, to use its leverage with key countries at the United Nations, both inside the Security Council and outside it. They are well positioned to do so. And it may be for Saudi Arabia, rather like it is for other regional states such as Turkey, much easier to push hard on this particular issue, especially in conformity with the wishes of the people in the region, rather than perhaps, and also perhaps reflect some of the criticism that they may be receiving with regard to other situations in the region, not least regarding them.
Question right here.
Thank you. I'm Hassan Al-Jafouri. I was attending some Arabic sessions, which is the same subject related to the Palestinian membership in the United Nations. And there, my friends, the Qataris, and they were saying all the time that the US is going to use the veto, and that's also wasted time and efforts to that. And I said, you know, the American foreign policy is run is influenced by the lobby, the Israeli lobby in the United States. And I wrote a letter to the Board of Ministers here in Qatar that once the revolutions are over in the Arab world, then better Qatar relies on GCC countries to support a lobby in the U.S. That lobby would consist of Jewish, moderate Jewish, Israeli Jewish who are sympathizing and supporting the Arab side, American Jewish who are also speaking our voice. They are liberals and they are moderate. And those who are American, moderate Americans who are after peace and after human rights. And I thought that those people would be invited to come to conferences, especially to Qatar, and we would give them voice in Al Jazeera, in other media, and we would be given different kinds of support, so that lobby, the Arabian lobby in the US, is not actually Arabian lobby, it's American lobby, but more friendly to the Arabs, would create such a sort of balance with the American, with the Israeli lobby in the US, and would give more support and more push to the American foreign policy. I always write letters, and most of my letters end up in the dustbin. So we Arabs, Muslim Arabs, moderate people, and I personally was asked by Qatari government to send my child, my son with the Israeli children, to the state of Maine. They had a camp, and what they called it, Seeds of Peace. And I said, I gave approval. I said, I am a man after peace. And I spoke to my child, and my child hesitated in the beginning, but then he agreed to go. And child went to, at that time, we believed the Israelis. They said, we want peace with you, and we want to live together in peace in Palestine. And I am Hassan al-Jafouri, everybody knows in Qatar, I have a good heart, and I believe all these stories. And then my child came, and then Netanyahu came, and Netanyahu was as bad as Al-Qaeda, he's so much extremist. And I am, and I am guess I'm a vegetarian, but there is one point I want to say. In the days of George Bush, the American Embassy here in Qatar used to invite us. They called me Hassan al-Jufairi, please come to our National Day, Independence Day. When congressmen, come from America, they invite me for coffee, they make me talk to them. And since Obama came, I don't know what happened. I ignored. Really, I think this is a real story. I am ignored. When I go to Georgetown or Brookings, I raise my arm, they make me the last person to speak. Al Jazeera camera switched off and I am talking here. He directs the camera to the other side. I don't know what happened. And I'm sorry, very
angry. Thank you. Do you want to comment on the whole
comment on what you said about the politics and I won't take it on directly, but what I will acknowledge, of course, is that all politics is local. And certainly on the Israeli side, it has shown resilience, consideration for that, the resilience of the Netanyahu government, in that perhaps he knew if he took more far-reaching positions, and there have been attempts even more recently, with Shimon Peres and Barak to map out some parameters. Prime Minister Netanyahu, in the end, decided not to go with those because it would have a detrimental impact on his coalition. Also, on the American side, I don't want to infer too much here, but just last week, I think there was a by-election in the 9th District of New York, a very solidly Jewish Democratic district. And for the first time, the Democrats lost this since 1923. And some of it, people are saying, may well be to do with dissatisfaction in terms of how Obama has been handling the Middle East issues as well. Again, it is a consideration. We're now into election season in the United States for Obama and the advice that he's getting. I'd also say we may well get an invitation from the Obama White House. We probably wouldn't get one from Netanyahu.
That's a question. Okay. You
want to jump in?
Just a question.
Okay.
Okay,
question. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Nathalie Lee here. I'm a senior in Georgetown. Over the summer, I have the privilege of being in an internship in Washington, D.C., where we had the opportunity to go to the Department of State. And we got the opportunity to sit with one of the Middle East policy advisors, and this topic came up. And his argument that he kind of portrayed was that it interrupts the negotiations if Palestine becomes a state in the UN. And to my limited understanding, and this is why I'm asking, it kind of seems to make more sense to me that if you're negotiating with a united body, that it would have more progress rather than disrupt it and completely ruin any negotiations. And so that's part A. And I think I forgot part. Oh, I remember part. And my only question is, recently the U.S. and Israel have been kind of, I feel, reached the point of their arguments are not even logical anymore, where it almost sounds ridiculous in some instances. At one point, are people starting to get just not believe it anymore? Is there any public resistance against some of how they justify this?
You mean for the Palestinians? You mean? You mean stop the individual Palestinian going to the negotiation?
Yes.
I think this process since started in 1993, and it was obvious that the international community, and I must say some of the external forces led by the United States, they tried to set the agenda of the Palestinians. And this is
quite basically, when you see, when we witnessed the election in 2006 and the victory of Hamas, and that, you know, whether you recognize Israel, whether you recognize the street or agreement, then or law abide law. But this never happened because you said that, didn't it? And then more important, we call it Arabic Shaitan al-Aqal. You made the others Satan. You say, you know, Hamas is Satan, so you can't include it. But I remember one of the points in February 2006, I raised in London and in Paris, one of the, my previous I had, that look, you are radicalizing part of the Palestinian people because you don't want to accept the fact that you made a mistake when you were radicalized Fatah before. Fatah was, you know, you refused Fatah for a while and then radicalized Fatah and then you accepted Fatah in the beginning of 90. So basically, they did the same thing with Hamas. They divided the Palestinian society and they say, okay, there is no united, we don't have one voice from this line. They are playing on this game, and they don't want to see this line, one voice. And remember the government, which was actually formed by both Fatah and Hamas, has been actually rejected by the national community and the court led by Tunder, rejected any kind of cooperation with it. So basically, we should not forget that this division within us, one of the very important factors that is the national community, which is based on this kind of division. It's like the last word in this context. I think the whole issue of negotiation from the beginning, the aim was is to secure Israel, is to make sure that Israel is secure. And without the consideration of Palestinian interests, they don't have the right to have a normal life. So basically, as long as this mindset, this way of thinking exists, I don't think so this will lead to anything. Even if they now speak about, okay, let's get this recognition, and then we will continue negotiation. But this will not be any kind of, I would say, a positive result.
Very quickly, I mean, the point you made in terms of state-to-state relations, it is a point which is often made now. You know, what is the harm in having state-to-state relations discussing issues such as borders and security, which would hold the parties much more responsible and force them towards some sort of negotiation? It's something that I have quite a lot of sympathy with, if only because it levels the playing field now in terms of negotiating. What you were pointing to, it was very much that we had a skewed set of priorities often in negotiations, and yet when you have much more of a state-to-state discussion, these are much more formalized and perhaps enable us to achieve much more on those core issues.
Okay, we're running out of time, so we'll take three questions in this round. Palestinian Ambassador, if you want to jump into your question, and then here, and then all the way in the back right there.
I just want to ask neutral questions more than Mr. Salman. From your deep understanding to the American politics and the way the American administration lives in such positions, do you think that the Americans, if they use the veto, the next day they will start weird procedures to punish the Palestinian Authority for that? And such punishment, as I said, and I'm sure, I still insist on that, it would hurt the American interest much more than it hurts the Palestinians, you know? Do you think that they're going to go ahead with such a procedure, or they will come to the Palestinians and say, let's turn the page, start the new page, and try to come up with new proposals to bridge the gap between the parties and the machines? Because here I just want to lose that Mr. Abbas insists that even while he's doing the conditions and even after submitting the application to the general and whatever the result is, he is insisting that one day he will come back and share. He wants to improve, you know, the Palestinian position in the machine and to have
Israel
is to accept the Palestinian negotiations.
So,
can we have a break, please?
Sure.
Thank you. John Rodriguez, professor of Western University.
Qatar. This question is directly for Salman. So we all agree, there's a very strong consensus that the U.S. needs to be very bad for the U.S. What do you see as the likelihood that the U.S. might be able to persuade, and thinking specifically, either Russia or China, to cast a veto instead? Because both of those states have concerns about their own populations and the whole idea of sovereignty and statehood of the U.S. And so the U.S. could avoid actually casting the veto, but have veto cast in Security Council.
Okay, I'll bring it back.
Hi, my name is Tati Nash and I'm from Georgetown University. My question is basically, you can say it's three parts. First of all, as a Palestinian, before this proposal, before any of these negotiations, I was personally against, a two-state solution because of what you can refer to as islands within Palestinian islands within Israel. Which I think, the checkpoints and all of these things that passing go through basis. I don't know if you could please express to what extent you agree or disagree with this, that it would be, and how, let's say it does work out and, Palestine is declared, as a member of UN, how they would be able to work around that. And also, if we say that, Palestine does become a member of the UN, what kind of conditions, if we talk about the Human Development Index or anything of that sort, what kind of conditions would the Palestinians be live in the state of Palestine after we give, would it really be better for Palestinians, for Palestinian citizens? What kind of, are they going to maybe, undergo a trade embargo with Israel or be completely isolated, and a lot of factors, of course, come into play, like education, younger generations. How do all these factors add up? Will it really be better for the Palestinians?
Thanks. I just want to take whatever parts of those three questions.
Sure. U.S. punishing the VA. No, I don't think it will. And actually, the answer lies actually in Jerusalem. I think there's been a realization that there's a great danger that the VA could collapse and that they would be left holding the baby. And certainly the State Department and the White House have been trying to convince those in Congress who are taking a different view that this is actually detrimental to U.S. interests and even to Israeli interests. So in the short term, I don't think that's the case, but we can't guarantee that the pressure will continue to build within Congress and also will be aided by certain key ministers and factions from within Israel as well. But in the immediate aftermath, I don't think so. And that, of course, shows the lack of leverage that the U.S. has in trying to convince the Palestinians not to go down this route. So on that, and let me say also, I suggested earlier regarding the Europeans, I don't think for a second that the Europeans are going to cut aid or anything like that. They've been long supporters of the Palestinian statehood project, and I think they will continue in that respect. But certainly, there will be some hard discussions still to be had in the aftermath of whatever happens, if it goes not according to how the Europeans are wishing. And then just on the Russian and Chinese people, they've already declared that they're going to vote for Palestinian membership. In fact, the Russians, I think it was Prime Minister Lavrov, or maybe the President, who said, we'll do whatever the Palestinians want us to do. And of course, they've realized that this is such a hot button issue in the context of the Middle East. And whilst they've been rightfully criticized for dragging their feet, and frankly, they're disgraceful. Blocking of action regarding Syria, for example, that they wouldn't necessarily bring a stake on Palestinians. I can talk about the results at the minute. I'll just quickly say that, of course, what you're really referring to is the viability of the Palestinian state, especially as it looks now. And yes, if you have a series of land disputes that you can't really call that a viable state. So of course, a lot will have to come out of the negotiations in terms of what is acceptable in an agreement to Palestinians. And of course, going back to the discussions in Camp David and Taba, and then Palestinians would say, well, we were being given a sort of framework of a house, but we weren't being given the stairs or the plumbing to make it very livable or very viable. So that's absolutely essential. If you're able to get the right kind of the two-state deal, I think Palestinians are extremely ingenious in how they managed to even cope with the conditions that they've lived in now. We're still seeing growth in both the West Bank and Gaza, albeit from various points, and especially if they're allowed to trade across their borders. The Palestinians are allowed to get the fruit and vegetables and their furniture and other things that they make. I think for a relatively small population, they do rather well if they get the chance. It's my final point is notable to me when I used to actually live in Gaza, even in the height of the Intifada, you would see kids going to school. I've lived in other conflict zones, and that wasn't always the case. You know, the emphasis on education and relatively high levels of education, even finding ways of educating children when they can't even go out of their houses through television or other media, has meant that they've had coping strategies. But yes, we have lost a generation who's been productive, and of course that continues, and that will continue until we have a Palestinian state alongside it.
Just two quick points. I think this is a new chapter in this conflict. It's unlikely to see a very bright result or quick result, because basically this is a process. And I think Palestinians used for this kind of long term, and you have an emphasis on the way to have a patient. I think they need it more now, because a lot of things around them is in favor of it. I think the rule of Turkey is crucial, and I think the rule of Turkey, if it continues, will change the whole game of the region. Israel has to take into consideration that this is a real state. It is not Iraq, it is not Arab states. It's a state, it's a mature state. Turkey is a mature state. And that state already shaped, defined its interests, and based on that moves, regardless of ruling, whether secular or Islamist. I think this is a mature state. Israel will think a lot about its movement in the region. And I think good Palestinian benefit from that movement, and I think the meeting between Obama and Erdogan will have a lot of consequence on the American position toward the whole issue. We have to look at the issue seriously, and I think this will affect the whole dynamic of this conflict.
Okay, we have time for two quick questions, and I'll ask each speaker to make closing remarks. Mike Stevens Brucey, did you have a question?
I did, a lot of wise people asked anything before. So given that, I will try and find a line to ask you somehow. Your description of many of these UN Security Council meetings was extremely eloquent. My wondering is that continuous US posturing about exercising the veto in itself, is that not damaging in the first place? So even if the scenario is avoided and one of your meticulously researched scenarios comes true, do you not think the damage to US credibility has already occurred, given that it is clear that the US position is to be against the declaration of an allied state?
Okay, and your last question.
Whether the state will be acceptable or not.
I believe we are witnessing now from the new, perhaps, transition phase, which will change a bit with the rules of the politics in Bangladesh. I'm coming from Turkey, from Tunisia, where has been the first revolution. And I remember it on the 15th of January, the crowd were talking about the first step to Versailles. This reflects also another way to be in our world. And although our states, Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and Gaza, you have something like 3,000 kilometers of the Muslim states. Yes, we are not, but those countries are not yet ready to have a very big weight on the scene, but I believe within a few years, hopefully, the thing will change. And here, as I said perhaps in the last conference on the same subject, the West started to realize this. And we are witnessing now in these countries, maybe in Tunisia, Egypt, perhaps in Europe, that has just started, the danger between privacy of these revolutions on the plans of the West for the Asian and for the Palestinian project. And we are witnessing real threats to these revolutions, actually, by getting to a lot of interferences. By many props, okay, around all of this to try to contain a bit the new path so that this strategic reserve would not affect very much what so. But I believe, as said our friend, that there are two stages which passed already this stage of like Turkey, for example. And if things will go well in these countries, in Tunisia, Libya, Egypt, and perhaps Gaza, things will not be easy for the United States. And perhaps next time, if they will escape the situation this time, I believe this is the end of the era. And next time, probably they will not be in the same situation. They will be in much more peaceful, okay, in the future.
So, the second question, you make the part of this question and then the part of the promise.
Thank you for those questions and those remarks. I really agree with you. We are at the end of an era and we're at the start of another one, so we're not quite sure the direction in which all of this is going. I'll tie this in, my remarks, with also the question, the eloquent question from Steve over there. Yes, you can talk of the European Union as damaging, but you know, at the end of the day, it's the policies that matter. And yes, we do worry the amount of diplomatic energy that the United States is spending on this. It seems as if the whole goal is just to stop the UN action rather than, in fact, even charting a way forward, even though this is what the rhetoric seems to be. And so much of this linking to the Arab awakenings, people's awakenings, so much of the discussion around Washington has been about balancing values and interests. And yet, if we accept that in a new era, people matter, people's rights, their dignity, their right to representation, their right to self-determination, these things matter, then I actually think the US is still well placed in order to be able to realize its interests by actually falling back on its own values for those kinds of things and supporting it. And certainly in the case of Palestine, the opportunity for it is here to show real leadership. And it can lead. It can lead, and it will bring the international community with it, and it will bring Israel with it. Right now, it's not doing itself any favors, and it's not doing Israel any favors. Until and when President Obama and those around him understand that, as I said before, I'm afraid, despite I know some of the real hard work and personal efforts of many Americans in this particular region, they will emerge as one of the biggest losers of what's going on.
history of our world, and we are starting with the contemporary history, where basically where the aspiration of people is leading the change, where basically we expect them to see more authoritarian regimes, where basically they change, they make a decision about everything, and they don't want to take into consideration the interests of their own people. And as part of that, I think the issue of Palestine is the core of that. In the last 60 years, Palestinian matter has been dealt with as part of supporting the legitimacy of totalitarian regimes. I don't think so this would be the case in this century. But if you look at the slogan of from different streets in Arab countries where they witnessed the revolutions, Palestinian wants in their hearts and their minds. The case of Egypt is one, but Tunisia as well, I think it is the same. The delay of the solution in Syria is because of Palestine. If Syria in North Africa, there would be different way of dealing with Syria. Because of Palestine, Syria matter has not been solved yet. Because they wanted to secure Israel first and then to think of what's going to happen to Bashar al-Assad. So basically, I think we expect a real change, and this change will influence the whole dynamic about Arab-Israeli conflict. I'm not sure the United States will be the leader in that. Let's remember that Soviet Union fell in 1991, but still Russia act as a strong power. The United States may continue this act in the same role, but doesn't have the same influence. This will take us to the point we will find some bit of different powers raised from there and there, they will contact. We have to rely on our efforts, our own aspiration as a people of the region to make the change we wish, which actually secure our interests and our rights. Thank you.
On that note, I think we'll close there. Thank you to both of our speakers and thanks to all of you for coming. We'll have a reception right in the next building here with some food and drinks, so I hope you can join us for that, and we'll see you next time. Thanks.